So yeah, so I guess we are back after 6 months. Six
That's half a
months.
year.
It is half a year. But we've been busy not doing podcast stuff. What have we been busy doing, guys? Anna, do you want to start?
I'm on research sabbatical at the moment, which is really fun. So normally I spend my day-to-day teaching students about coaching. But I've been lucky enough to be relieved of those duties, and my colleagues at ARU in Cambridge are probably all cursing me. So it means that I get a chance to focus on some research stuff, which I normally have to do just alongside teaching, but I get to focus solely on that for I have been doing that for the past few months, which has been really fun. Been finishing off a few bits and bobs, gone to visit a few people that I am writing things with, which has been nice. Sadly, didn't get to go to New Zealand, which was the original plan to visit our friend Rob Townsend, who was on the Paralympic episode that we're going to do our chat about tonight. Finally, he's been pestering me to find out when we're going to do it. So I didn't get to go and see him yet, but I have been doing some interesting stuff to do with world rugby and women's rugby and coaching and injury prevention and all those things together. So watch this space.
Are you able to share any of that, what you've been doing?
We'll leave that for another episode.
Ooh, I look forward to it. Laurie, what have you been up to? You've been busy.
Well, I think we all have. No, my life's changed quite a lot. I'm still doing some consultancy, but the vast majority of my time is now spent with the coaching team at UK Sport, which I'm like really delighted to be able to say. So essentially, broad brush in that team, we help to try and ensure that coaching remains a sustainable competitive advantage and is cracking our beer open through the development of world-class coaching and coaches. So kind of on a day-to-day basis, I collaborate with sports and through an understanding of context, try and ensure that support that we're offering meets or is accountable and responsive to the individual team and organizational needs. So yeah, I mean, like prior to coming to UK Sport, I got to work with some like pretty incredible people, many of which I dearly miss. But one of the many reasons for going to UK Sport was the opportunity to collaborate with a team, single team on a day-to-day basis, which I've never had before, believe it or not. So the individuals in that team, like some of them have been leading my development for a long time. They are people that I have a huge amount of respect and admiration for. They really care about their work. They're funny. They've got good crack as well, which makes it more enjoyable. It's exciting, and you know, none of us have ever done this. It would be totally unprofessional to, you know, to bring like examples and case studies of our work to the podcast, but undoubtedly the experiences that I'm having will influence the perspectives that I bring. So yeah, the work is good. And like working with sports I've never worked with before, which is really cool. But I've missed this. I've really missed this podcast. And I mean, it's not, I was thinking about it before we came on, like it's not a platform, you know, it's not to platform any of us, obviously. But I've just missed like engaging in discussion with the two of you. It's like really developmental for me. So yeah, it's good to be back. Derek.
Look, I guess it's one thing, it's a privilege probably for you to work with UK Sport, but I haven't worked with you, collaborated with you, learned with you over the years. I think you're an incredible asset for that organization. I think they're really, really lucky to have you. So I think they got a good one there.
Thank
Absolutely.
you.
And I hope to continue to learn from you now that you're working and learning from the big dogs. So poacher turned gamekeeper, I think, is what they say, Laurie, right?
I wouldn't be doing this work without you, or Anna, for sure, for sure. You know, like, I mean, genuinely, the skills that we've developed, the discussions we've had, the topics that have been raised, I hope that they make me better in the work that I'm doing. So I need more of it. Also, just love the beer and the crack, right?
Yeah, no, for sure, for sure.
Yeah. Tell us what you've been doing, Derek. You've had a very busy 6 months.
Yeah, you could say that. I guess the last episode that came out was the Paralympic special. I believe it was the Winter Paralympics that sparked us to go, oh shit, we've not done this in a while. And so rightly so, we wanted to do a two bare minimum to those guys. But yeah, since that episode came out, I finished a master's, started the PhD, changed job temporarily. So I've gone from Sport Scotland for 18 months into the Scottish Qualifications Authority, where I'm supporting the development of the new higher national programmes in physical activity and health, which is great because we're perhaps widening the reach of what we can do in terms of developing the workforce beyond leisure and sport, but really looking to target that health agenda, which is really cool. So it's a different avenue for me, having looked at coach development for a number of years. So it's challenging my skill set, but also opening my mind up to other aspects where sport can have a positive impact against wider outcomes within society. So that's been good. And I moved house. So been pretty busy, which all of those things combined with changes in your life and Anna persistently being busy, I think has led to the fact that we've had a few false starts trying to bring ourselves back onto a Teams call. We were just laughing beforehand as to, you know, how hilarious it is that this is the first time we've been able to get the three of us lined up in 6 months. But I think that's just indicative of who we are as people, the stuff that we take on, and how busy we make our lives. So I'm hoping that we rebuild and put back in space in our diaries for this, because the podcast was never meant to be a burden on anyone. It's a means of feeding our curiosity. So I'm hoping that we can rebuild a bit of momentum around having the podcast back. And there's no better way to kick off a return to the pod than consider some beers. What you guys got, Stutter?
I went ahead and cracked on with what is probably my favourite beer. So I don't know if I've actually we've talked about this at all yet.
You like
it?
It's
a Belgian
beer.
Yeah, it's Left Blonde. Just, you know, it's nothing too sort of radical, but it's just a solid, like, I just really like it. Yeah, it's a good one. So yeah, I've cracked on with that with my lovely Belgian Trappist beer glass, because you have to like let it breathe and be able to smell it and stuff.
That's a fancy glass. And I do, it's worth noting, we've got a reputation of radical beer on this, haven't we?
Do we?
A few people have made a comment, yeah, quite highbrow, super trendy beer. That was never the intention. So I wonder what direction we'll go with this.
Is it not your intention? I've got high beer standards, so I just want to get those out to the world. So then my other one is another Belgian called La Goudale Ale. I don't know if it means good ale, maybe. This one is another quite strong one, 7.2% from Flanders, but also given to me by my colleague Matt Dowling, because I looked after his dog, Cooper. Shout out to Cooper, the Golden Retriever. He was lovely.
Nice. Before we jump onto Laurie, I think the reason why we're fairly highbrow in the beers is because we're still paying a penance for Phil Llewellyn bringing Sam Miguel onto the podcast. There's still no words. I can't believe he did that. Just while I brew on that, Laurie, what have you got?
Okay. This is like round four, because we kept trying to come together and I kept getting like really, really cool beers and then just drank them because we couldn't get online. But I have a Golden Ale G40 from West Brewery, which is I don't know if they brew it. You'll know this, Derek, at Templeton Building, which is where the Sport Scotland offices are. And I've also got from Tempest Brewing Company, a little Session IPA. I think Tempest are based in the Borders. What have you got, Derek?
So we've got a Pavlov's dog, largely because I salivate every time I look at a beer, and that's from Williams Brothers. And I've also, speaking of radical, I've got a Shea Guava Radical Lager. I've never tried a guava beer before.
Oh no, put that in the fridge, mate.
Will I put it in the fridge? Maybe I'll just crack open a bottle of wine. Is that loud? I don't know. We'll see how we go.
Yeah, I don't know.
We make the rules.
I'm open to experiences, so I'll try the Shea Guava. But yeah, that's William Brothers as well. Laura, you've got a face in you. I've got the fear about that one already.
Yeah, I think I've had guava beer before and didn't like it very much either. So
have you tried the new sour beer? There's a new market for beer that goes off, and it's now like sour fruity IPAs.
I don't think that's beer that goes off. It's beer that's fermented in the air, isn't it? Is that just another way of saying beer that goes off?
Another way of saying that.
Yeah. I like sour beers. They're good if you don't like beer. Good way to start drinking beer. Because they don't taste like what you'd expect beer to taste like.
I've got a child in the other room. I'm going to refrain from commenting on what they potentially taste like if they don't taste like beer.
Yeah, I can't drink them either. They're awful. I really cannot drink them.
I am looking forward to widening my palate in terms of beers over the next few months as we start getting back into this. Maybe people want to drop us a tweet and let us know if there's certain beers they want us to try. Anyway, we're not here to talk about beers that much. We're here to catch up on the previous episode. You guys were on it, not me. And Anna, you led it. I'd be interested to understand your reflections first. I've obviously got some reflections of my own, but I'd be keen to just understand what you guys thought of the episode.
Yeah, I really very much enjoyed listening to it back and not having that anxiety of having to lead it while I was listening to it. So, obviously I knew all the people that were invited, so wanted it to go well. And that thing of sort of like asking the questions or leading it and making sure everyone's heard is quite anxiety inducing. So I know that people sometimes get quite anxious listening to themselves back, but actually it was nice and relaxing listening to it back and not having to worry about that. So yeah, I just really enjoyed listening back to it, especially after such a big gap from when we recorded it, and just felt proud that we'd put together something that was pretty good based on the quality of the guest. Really,
I've listened to it a couple of times now, and Rob Tabo and Tanya were fantastic, and what I really liked was just how much they recognize, well, certainly Rob in recognizes his own biases in terms of his perceptions or past perceptions of disability sport. I think some of the comments on the episode, in particular around the classifications we don't see in terms of the coverage on TV, really led me to just consider, actually, have we really seen para sport in its truest sense? Or do we just see a small slice of what it is to be a para-athlete on the world stage? And, you know, Rob and Tabo and Tanya lifting the lid a little bit and what it's really like actually was a bit of an eye-opener for me, and it just reflected perhaps some of my ignorance around para-sport. So, it was definitely an eye-opener or ear-opener for me.
Yeah, I agree. I thought it was really humbling, and it was definitely a bit of a catalyst for what have been a lot of decisions and actions on my part, and also just actively trying to better understand this. I also thought there was something quite cool in the episode in bringing on, very often we bring on people that we know or have some history with, but the relationship between Tabo and Rob I thought made for a super interesting dynamic during the conversation, because they just, like, we got to a really gritty place that I think was facilitated by their relationship and the work they've done together, and undoubtedly the trust that they have in you, Anna, and it's maybe something to consider moving forward. But there was a lot of statements that stood out for me. I think Rob said the lens of disability should disrupt your normative practice, but I couldn't help make a connection between that statement and something else that was said, which I think was by Tabo, and early coaches needing a repertoire of knowledge and skills to be able to coach whoever is in front of them. And by infusing disability into coach education and development, would we, you know, at what point does that disruption to our normative practice stop happening? You know, what would it take? And you know, that repertoire of knowledge and skills and the potential barrier for participation. You know, I've seen it, I've been a part of it, I've experienced it with family and friends. Yeah, so that was great. It was a great episode.
Yeah, the thing that kept running around in my mind at the start of the episode and it started to come in towards the end is this biopsychosocial aspect. And I suppose when you reflect on what it is or what it means to be a coach and your role, by and large, is to respond to athletes' wants and needs, and whether they be biologically, psychologically, or socially, or at least understanding those influencing factors when designing practice, designing interventions, engaging in conversations, considering short, medium, and long-term goals. Why is that not wholly transferable into disability or working with para-athletes, if that's the fundamental philosophy of practice that coaches may have? I guess I'm keen to unpack that a little bit, that if our role as coaches is to be adaptable, flexible, and bending to wants and needs, why can't all coaches do that with disability athletes? I'm just keen to unpack that a little bit and see what your thoughts are.
I think you've raised a great discussion point, and I actually think that you need to explain it a little bit further, or just offer up some of your thinking behind it to ensure that I have a solid enough understanding of what it is you're keen to discuss, Derek.
Yeah, well, so if we accept the fact that no two athletes, no two contexts, no two days, no two sessions are the same, coaches are constantly dealing with the conditional nature of working with athletes, which means we need to draw upon what might work with who and what context and why. So there's almost this synoptic system of thinking. So we have a fairly holistic view of the world and a fairly holistic view of coaching, where we can draw on a number of knowledge sources to take an evidence-informed approach to how we're designing practice or working with athletes in context. So if that's a philosophy of practice or a system of thinking or working with athletes, why does it matter if they're able-bodied or disabled? Does the same system not apply to both populations of people?
Awesome. I'm glad you explained it, because I've had similar thoughts. Anna, do you want to jump in?
I got more confused by the explanation, actually. I was ready to jump in the first time. I was more thinking about the adapting and how, as a coach, you can only adapt based on what you know or your experiences. So unless you bring someone else or something else to help you. So that was just my thoughts on that, based on some of my research, actually. But yeah, I got a bit confused by the second explanation, not gonna lie.
So surely then it is the breadth and depth of the knowledge base that allows you to adapt to the individual needs of athletes. And I agree, I actually really dislike typically any divisive type language I struggle with a bit. But in order to adapt, you have to have the breadth of knowledge, skills and experience to be able to do that. So is it, Derek, a question of, are we equipping coaches with a wide enough breadth of knowledge at an early enough stage to be able to adapt to meet the needs of the individuals that they're developing?
I guess the challenge I have is coaches operating with a degree of humility and knowing what they don't know and being motivated to find out what they need to know in order to meet athletes' wants and needs. It's very easy to type google.com into a web browser and find out what you need to know in order to meet those athletes' needs to some degree. Everybody's got a network of coaches, everybody's got a governing body that they can access. There's online resources, there's academic papers, there's YouTube videos. So I don't think the knowledge is beyond our grasp if we've got the humility and the I guess motivations to go out and find these things out for ourselves. I'm not going to not work with an athlete just because I don't have that knowledge. If I've got an absence of knowledge that I need to meet someone's wants and needs, and I'm going to go out and try and find it.
And would you apply that similar philosophy at a grassroots level? Do you think it applies in all contexts?
Absolutely. I've worked with P1s, so 4, 5, and 6-year-old kids. I've coached women, I've coached adult males, I've coached kids in the pathway. I've coached disability, I've worked with kids with autism. And when I worked as a development officer, I could be working with all of those populations in any given week. So I needed to be adaptable and draw on past experiences, whether it was with that population group or not, to make a judgment call as to what was right in that moment in time. Now, I'm not working with elite para athletes. I'll hold my hands up to that. So it might seem like a fairly flippant comment, but I guess it's just my own perception of what it means to be a coach is we can't wait for knowledge to come to us. We've got to go out and find it for ourselves when it comes to developing a practice for the people that we work with.
I'm quite interested in like how you apply that knowledge and so yeah, like knowledge in action. Have you got any stories of that, Derek? Of give an example of something that you felt you needed to know to be able to coach some of those groups effectively, went and found it and then tried it out.
I do like it when you put me on the spot. I was a forwards coach always. When I became a head coach, I needed to understand and appreciate all aspects of the game, attack, defence, backline play. Or if I was moving up a level, say for example, when we got promoted from Nat 1 into the Premiership, I sought out the advice of pro coaches, coaches who operated within those environments before, shadowed sessions, met them for coffees, tried to understand their point of view in terms of why they might do certain things in certain contexts, how I might develop backline play when I've got absolutely no knowledge of that. And anybody who has got an appreciation for rugby, it's very difficult as a forward to coach a back. So that's one aspect, I guess. Going back to when I worked with kids with a disability, well, I would reach out for resources and with Scottish Disability Sport. It's funny hearing things like step and aim being used in the context of the episode when those models I would take and try and apply in practice. I'm not saying that I was an expert by any means when I'm working with these population groups, but I would give everything a crack and see what worked. But I didn't step away from or turn down the opportunity to work with people just because I didn't have the knowledge.
Resisting the urge to go into a full research interview about how you tell what works and stuff. We should.
You could also give the answer that pretty much everything works. Sometimes when you're working with athletes, it doesn't really matter what you do. The coach might be fairly inconsequential in the context of that athlete's development. They could or would improve whether you were there or not. They might get worse whether you were there or not. It doesn't really matter. I don't think in the context of performance, coaches have as much influence as coaches think.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. In that there's no evidence, so.
Laurie, you're pensive.
No, I think just knowing you, Derek, it doesn't surprise me in the slightest. The emphasis you place on an individual's curiosity and the importance of that in being able to work effectively to meet the needs of people. And I also recognise the body of work that you've been involved in over the last 3 years in developing programmes of learning and development for coaches, and more specifically, like, formal education programmes. So I just wonder, to what extent, what are your views on the integration of developing a curriculum that accounts for individuals with impairment within that?
Yeah, I kind of assumed we were going to get to this point, and using Anna's word, evidence is an interesting one. So there's a body of evidence there to say that we've worked in Scotland to integrate concepts of disability sport, coaching the person in front of you, into our qualifications here in Scotland. Whether it's the leading in coaching sessions award, whether it's the assisting in coaching sessions award, whether it's the coach practitioner qualification, we ensure that Scottish disability sport were represented in the design teams. And we didn't want disability to be an isolated and elective part of the qualification. It needed to be embedded throughout the whole thing. So I can hand on heart say that, you know, what Tabo and Rob were talking about in terms of working with athletes or participants with a disability is we don't even need to speak to it because it's part of the qualification.
And listening back, are there any questions that the two of you would have liked to ask? I know you've been put under the spotlight, Derek, so far, but given that you weren't a part of it and you listened back, anything that you know you were keen to revisit more or are keen to pursue in the future, maybe have been, in terms of your understanding?
There was a couple of things for me that really popped out. There was a tension between coach the athlete, not the disability, versus coach the disability as a feature of the athlete. And there were some interesting tensions there that I was keen to drill down on, because from the athlete perspective, Tanya was like, no, what I really enjoy about the coaches that I work with is they treat me just the same as anyone else. And she talked to the impact of the pandemic, that she was she was part of a very equitable environment, that there was no real difference in terms of let's call it population specific. There wasn't a population specific program or environment. She was there with able-bodied athletes, and able-bodied athletes were there with disability athletes. And I think absolutely, that's a great way to be. Albeit that's not always going to be possible. And again, it goes back to my ignorance around the severity of low classification disability. That, again, back to the athletes that you don't see, and some of the complex needs of those individuals. Because while they might be elite athletes, they're still vulnerable people that need a lot of care. And what I was really struck by was the story of the athlete who couldn't have their mother there, or couldn't have their parent there. Yet Sky Brown, when she was competing for GB in the Olympics, had her father by her side the whole time. So why was Sky Brown allowed to have her parent there in terms of her care, but a para-athlete wasn't? Now, I know she's a 13-year-old kid, but come on. I've heard of accreditations being tight before in competition, but that's just beyond the ridiculous.
Speaking of complex needs, which you just spoke to there, there's a group of people, or there's an industry that I think should get a real acknowledgement here, and that is, and also having done an undergrad in sports engineering, which plays a huge part in performance sport, and often, you know, like the glitz and glam of, what am I trying to say here? Yeah, it, like individuals with serious impairment that require kind of bespoke solutions to allow them to participate and excel and flourish in their sport. There is some equipment that's designed that allow those athletes to do what they're able to do. And I think there's just a huge industry there that needs recognition, because I think it's amazing, you know, it's absolutely incredible. Yeah. But it's often just the sexy side of sports engineering with the, you know, the athletes that get lots of press and marketing and, you know, and anyway, I'm rambling. Beer's kicking in.
No, I think you make a really good point.
I think you know what I'm trying to say.
I think you make a great point.
I was going to say, actually, the sports engineering kind of prosthetics kind of side of things, we didn't talk about it in the podcast, but that for me brings it back to what we were talking about with coaches adapting. So when I worked at Archery GB with Tanya, I really enjoyed working on the Paralympic Academy because of the way that you could see coaches being forced to adapt to those different needs or different setups and different things that needed to happen to enable those people to compete or to train in ways that other people might just take for granted. And it reminded me of the S&C coach. He was called Rob Norman. And I really enjoyed seeing his kind of S&C sessions and the adaptations that he made for the Paralympic athletes just to get them to do their S&C programs. Because obviously stuff had to be accessible and like doable for those people. Maybe that makes those people that are working in Paralympic pathways better coaches because they're perhaps better able to adapt because they're forced to. I just thought it was a very interesting place to be part of. I also really enjoyed Tanya talking about that feeling of effortlessness when you're competing, when you're training, rather than being disabled by everything in the environment and the structures around you. And I think that's a worthwhile thing for everyone to reflect upon. And it did remind me of one of our previous episodes where we talked about like peak performance being effortless. It was like the adventure sports one, wasn't it? So just enjoyed hearing about that from Tanya's perspective.
Based on your experience with the archery guys, did the coaches collaborate with the engineers on the solutions to be made for the athletes in terms of the tech?
Not that I know of, but we had a guy called Ollie Logan, was sort of biomechanist, works at British Swimming now, I think. So he was, I'm sure he was involved in some of those discussions. I think it was quite a collaborative thing. And also archery is quite a techie kind of sport in that a lot of, I think Tanya mentioned it as well, a lot of the stuff is to do with like your equipment that you use and being able to maintain that and tweak that and use that to your advantage. So yeah, I'm not sure in terms of actually qualified engineers, but certainly a lot of collaboration to make things work for different people, and that's the same across all the pathways really.
Yeah, it just reminds me of something that was said on the podcast, the athlete is a problem to be solved, which kind of feeds into that notion of collaborating around what solutions we might find to remove the disability to allow them to have an effortless performance.
Yeah, I suppose that's the kind of seeing the athlete is disabled by everything around them, by the equipment that they're using, by the way that we do things.
I don't think the athlete being a problem to be solved is just something that we see in Paralympic sport.
Is the coach the problem that needs to adapt?
That's a big question. Yeah, I mean, to what extent do we see erroneous coaching behaviours persist within the system? We see some great coaching, I think, in our work, and we probably also see some not so great coaching because of a degree of entrenchment around their practice that's worked for them for so long, or their knowledge sources or their their practice is so ingrained that they're just not willing to change. So yeah, I definitely agree with you, Anna, that sometimes the coach is the problem to be solved within the system. Maybe one for another day.
Yeah. Laurie, what were your thoughts on listening back to it? We haven't really heard much of your reflections from it.
Have we not? Oh, I need to get a taxi then if that's the case, because I'm out. I think it was that, to go back to Derek's point, like if they're really going to be able to be adaptable, I think there is a knowledge base from an early stage that is necessary to be able to do that.
I think Coach Ed gets a bad rap in some of this, in terms of we make an assumption that coaches don't have the knowledge because it's not in coach education. And when you consider in real sort of mechanistic terms, right, a level one is 2 days, a day of that's assessment, so it's a day and a half's worth of knowledge. A level two in old money is 4 days. A day and a half of that is assessment, so it's 2.5 days of learning, and you've got to get Tic Tac in that as well. A level three is a year-long program where they're in and out of your environment, and if you don't work with disability athletes, then then you're not going to have disability as part of the curriculum within that, because the coach is the curriculum within the level three, I believe. And level four is fairly independent, and it's based on your practice and doing some independent studies of things that you're curious about as a coach to develop these academic skills, these systems of thinking, systems of knowing. And I think there's one aspect that we probably haven't pointed to, is that the athlete is the greatest resource for developing the knowledge you need to work with the athlete themselves. So you and I mentioned collaborations between the biomechanist, the coach, and the technologist. Well, to what extent is there collaboration between the coach and the athlete around working together to best meet the athlete's needs? And I think there was an interesting undercurrent to some of this, and Tabo mentioned a really interesting point in terms of what do the coaches that work with para athletes tweet about?
Yeah.
And are the athletes there, or are the coaches there for themselves? Are they there for the athlete? And I'd be really keen to understand some of that at more depth.
Yeah, you make some great points. A lot of it for me sits at like the participation and grassroots level. It's that, like the basic logistics of it, the kind of, I don't know, social accessibility of it for kids or adults with disabilities, and clubs being equipped to be able to provide for them, you know, never mind the knowledge base to adapt their practice, but just basic stuff like being able to get them in the door.
I think you make a very valid and very pragmatic point that I don't think we put anybody's nose out of joint. I mean, look, we're grossly underprepared, under-resourced to be able to accept everybody from society in, because of the costs of a local club in making their facility accessible, for example. We've got a number of rugby clubs that still don't have equitable shower and changing facilities. So let's not talk about able-bodied athletes and disability athletes for a second, but let's think about the trans and LGBTI community. And I know I'm opening a can of worms here, but I still don't think sport is in any way prepared to provide an equitable and open door for some of these communities to come in. So I don't think it's exclusive to disability sport at all. I think sport really needs to have a grown-up conversation with itself around to what extent it really is for everybody. And I might take some flack for that, but I think it's a conversation that needs to be had fairly openly and robustly.
Yeah, I'll back you on that, Derek. I agree.
First time for everything, Anna.
Must be the beer.
So, shall we look ahead to what will hopefully be a coupled together series between our schedules?
Well, I guess in the spirit of the podcast not being a burden, we've planned one episode so far. Very loosely, which is conceptualizing sport coaching. And we've got two guests lined up for that so far, which is John Lyle, who quite a lot of our listeners will know, and Andy Burns, who some of our listeners probably won't know Andy, but Andy's currently doing a PhD at Edinburgh Uni looking at interdisciplinary practice within sport coaching. And I think reading his recent systematic review, I think he's got a lot to offer in this space when we consider, for example, the coach as orchestrator. I'm really keen to hear and learn from both Andy and John, and hopefully we can line up a third guest for that. And again, if anybody out there is interested in filling a space, they're more than welcome to reach out. The only precondition is that you do not drink San Miguel. So Phil Llewellyn, that rules. You are pal. We'd be keen to understand anybody who's got an interest in sport coaching and conceptualizing sport coaching to reach out and engage with the episode.
Poor Phil.
He brought it on himself. Anna, Laurie, what were the ones that you were interested in bringing to the next series?
Well, we did have a chat about perhaps, I don't know, using the momentum of my research sabbatical, some of the cool people that I've met. It's been really fun, actually, kind of exploring a new sort of research area and just contacting people all around the world that are doing research in the area and seeing if they want to chat with me. And everyone's been very accommodating. I've spoken to loads of really cool people all around the world that are doing great work. So perhaps making the most of that, looking at concussion, women's rugby, coaching, how coaching can help with that. Yeah, could be a future episode if we can fit it in the schedule.
Yeah, I'd be really interested in that one. And I think sports like rugby is, there's this almost accepted norm that it's health harming. Rugby hurts, right? But actually, does it have to be that way? Do we need to dispel some of those conceptions, especially around head injuries, catastrophic injuries within the sport, which we still get? So I think that would be a fairly very, very interesting episode. Laurie?
I think given the cyclical nature of sport and off the back of Tokyo and Beijing, I have a few guests in mind that I'm keen to bring on who've been to many Olympic and Paralympic Games, both winter and summer, as athletes and coaches. And they're very different stages in their life after games, but I don't know, I've just got a wee conversation brewing in my head that I think could be quite cool. So yeah, just keen to understand what that journey has been like for them since. So yeah, it's my idea, and there are others, but they're really half-baked, to use the term that Anna frequently pulls Derek up for. We'll maybe just park those half-baked ideas just now.
Yeah, quote of the last series, it can't be half-baked if you're putting a citation in there.
Was that me?
That was you.
Don't remember that.
I'll put it out for you.
Unfortunately, everything's recorded, so you can't hide.
I did
have some notes from listening back to our previous Paralympic special episode about the very long question from Laurie, who acknowledged that it was a very, very long question. And I wondered if you should do an award for the longest question in the podcast series. Because I know that I wouldn't win that award.
Yeah, and I play Ticket to Ride. I don't know if you've played that game, but you get like lots of points if you make the longest train. So I'm just So yeah, I agree. We should award points for the longest question. Ticket to Ride, you should get it. It's a good game.
Can you explain a bit further what Ticket to Ride involves, please?
Yeah, so you get loads of little plastic trains. There's lots of different locations and you get given routes and you've got to build a train between those destinations. But you also get additional points if you get the longest train in the game.
So prize for the longest train of thought.
Yeah, exactly. I'll take those points with pride.
I'm about to try
it. Derek's on the guava.
Che guava. It's all right. Tastes like a monster. That's all right. It's not bad.
Low standards.
You're joking. Well, you can blame Emma because she ran out to the shop to buy them while I was putting the kids to bed.
Oh, if it's a gift, it doesn't matter if it tastes.
Oh, no. Well, she paid for it with my debit card, so it's not a gift.
We did
it
the very first one that we did that I had the chili beers for that my sister gave to me for. Yeah, they were.
Penis.
Rank.
Are we going to do another alcohol fueled episode? Because that was.
Yeah, Andy Burns has requested a whiskey special.
Was it Joe Rogan drank an entire bottle of whiskey on an episode and was absolutely.
Yeah.
That's very responsible. That could kill you.
True. Cool. I guess that's a really good jumping off point.
Yeah.
I can't express how good it is to be back on with you both. So. I'm really looking forward to building some momentum again over the next couple of months. So fingers crossed we can get the next episode done relatively swiftly and then on to a two beer minimum from there. It's not even a tongue twister.
Yeah, no, it was great.